they're soon arrested by Scottish police. But they've done the damage they intended.
They've obviously realised that asking nicely has not worked. The government hasn't made any lasting change and they have taken measures into their own hands where the government has chosen not to.
The activists, who were taken in court and released later, accused the Paris-headquartered multinational TALS group of making an array of lethal weapons that help enforce the Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. The Watchkeeper drone is one of the group's deadly products, developed in collaboration with a notorious Israeli weapons company that's been the target of these activists for years now.
In 2019, TALS made 8.3 billion euros in profit, and that wasn't just off the suffering and oppression of Palestinians. It was from the oppression of refugees worldwide. Their business is oppression, their business is genocide, and they're willing to sacrifice millions upon millions of lives for profit.
The building behind me used to house the headquarters of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. Earlier this year, and after 2 years of relentless direct action, Palestine Action say, they forced the company to close down and leave, getting one step closer to ending Israel's arms trade in Britain.
That came only 5 months after the company was forced to close up shop in the northwestern city of Oldham, Greater Manchester. Elbit Systems still has 8 more sites in the UK. Palestine Action say they will continue to throw a spanner in the works of Elbit and companies that collaborate with it, until they're all closed and until Palestine is free. Saeed Puriza, London.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a 2-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
As the race for the leadership of the UK ruling Conservative Party heats up, the fight for who will become Britain's next Prime Minister turns ugly. With bitter exchanges, leaked dodgy dossiers, and attacks on rivals' policies, the contest could quickly turn into a large-scale brawl. A flurry of weekend announcements has put the total count of top job hopefuls at 11, a large number filled with big and small names. Rishi Sunak tops with the most Tory MP supporters so far, with pro-Brexit Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt coming in second. However, critics say a long drawn-out contest will deepen economic uncertainty amid a cost-of-living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly, Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute. And I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. I suppose it's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. But, you know, I mean, you just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Absana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
زیارت قدیر. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Hello, dear listeners. Since we are passing through the 10 auspicious days of Wilayat, marking the completion of divine favors and the perfection of faith on the historic plain of Qadir Khum, where on the 18th of Zilhijjah in 10 AH, as per God's commandment, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon his progeny, while returning from the farewell pilgrimage, declared Imam Ali, peace be upon him, as the vicegerent, we present to you the ziyara, or standard form of salutation for the commander of the faithful on this occasion. Because of its length and its thought-provoking content, we have divided the ziyarat al-Ghadir into four parts. The translation was undertaken by Dr. Ali Ghuli Gharai, director of the English section of the Quranic Translation Institute in the holy city of Qom, who had earlier translated the Holy Quran into English. Please stay tuned for the first part. It is recommended to perform a bath, and after putting on clean clothes, one should turn towards the holy tomb of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, and recite, Peace on Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah, the seal of the prophets, the chief of the emissaries, the elect of the Lord of all the worlds, who was entrusted by Allah with his revelations and his prime commandments, and who is the seal of the previous prophecies and inaugurator of what is yet to come and is the custodian of all that. May Allah's mercy and his blessings, bounties, and greetings be upon him. Peace on the prophets of Allah, his apostles, archangels, and his righteous servants. Peace be on you, O commander of the faithful, chief of the legatees, heir to the knowledge of the prophets, friend of the Lord of all the worlds, and my guardian and guardian of all the faithful. May Allah's mercy and his blessings be upon you. Peace on you, O my guardian, O commander of the faithful, O Allah's trustee on his earth, his envoy amongst his creatures, and his conclusive testament to his servants. Peace on you, O Allah's true religion and his straight path. Peace on you, O great tiding, the one about which they differ and concerning which they will be questioned. Peace on you, O Commander of the Faithful. You had faith in Allah, while others worshipped other gods. You affirmed the truth while they gainsaid it. You waged jihad for the sake of Allah, while they shrank away from it. And you worshipped Allah, putting your exclusive faith in Him, bearing hardships patiently for the sake of God until your last breath. Indeed, may Allah's curse be upon the wrongdoers. Peace on you, O Master of Muslims, Leader of the Faithful, Imam of the God-weary, and Leader of the Devout, and may Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you. I affirm that you are the brother of the Prophet of Allah, his legatee, heir to his knowledge, trustee of his Sharia, his successor within his Ummah, the first to have faith in Allah and to affirm what was revealed to his Prophet. I affirm that he communicated whatever Allah had revealed concerning you, that he complied with his orders and made your wilaya and obedience to you mandatory for his Ummah, by taking from them the pledge of allegiance to you and giving you a preeminent authority over the faithful, such as Allah had given him. Thereafter he invoked Allah to be witness over them, and he said, "Have I not communicated this matter to you?" And they replied, "By Allah, yes." Whereat he said, "Allah be witness, and you suffice as witness and judge between your servants." So may Allah's curse be upon those who disputed your authority after having acknowledged it, and broke their covenant after they had pledging it solemnly. I testify that you fulfilled the covenant of Allah, the Most High, and that Allah will fulfill His covenant with you, and whoever fulfills the covenant he has made with Allah, He will give him a great reward. And I testify that you are the true commander of the faithful, whose authority has been proclaimed by God's revelation, and the Prophet made the Ummah pledge itself to that. I testify that you, your uncle, and your brother made a deal with Allah in exchange for your souls, whereat He revealed these ayahs concerning you, stating, "Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. They fight in the way of Allah, kill and are killed, a promise binding upon Him in the Torah and the Evangel and the Quran. And who is truer to his promise than Allah? So rejoice in the bargain you have made with him, and that is the great success. The faithful are penitent, devout, celebrators of Allah's praise, wayfarers who bow, prostrate, bid what is right, and forbid what is wrong, and keep Allah's bounds, and give good news to the faithful." O Commander of the Faithful, I affirm that those who have doubts about you do not have faith in the trusted Prophet, and that those who put others on a par with you deviate from the upright religion which has been approved for us by the Lord of all the worlds, who perfected it with your wilaya on the day of Qadir. I affirm that you are the one who is meant by the words of the Almighty and the All-Merciful. This indeed is my straight path, so follow it, and do not follow other ways, for they will separate you from his way. By God, those who follow others besides you have gone astray and misled others, and those who are hostile toward you deviate from the truth. O Allah, we have heard your command, and we obey and follow your straight path. So guide us, our Lord. Do not make our hearts swerve after you have guided us, and enable us to be of those who are grateful for your blessings. I testify that you always opposed self-seeking impulses and were committed to God-wariness, that you were well able to suppress your rage and pardon and forgive the people, that you were displeased when God was disobeyed and were pleased when God was obeyed, that you did what you were enjoined with, observed what was committed to your care, preserved what you were entrusted with, communicated that which you were charged with, and awaited what you had been promised. I testify that you did not conciliate with your opponents out of humiliation and weakness, nor your restraint in obtaining your right was due to fear, nor your desisting from fighting against the usurpers of your right was on account of evasion, nor did you express approval of that which was contrary to what God approves on account of laxity, nor did you falter for what befell you in the way of Allah, neither did you weaken nor abase yourself by failing to restore your right out of caution, to avoid danger or harm. God forbid that you be such. Rather, when treated unjustly, you resigned yourself to your Lord's will, leaving your matter to him, and you admonished them, but they would not be admonished. You advised them, and they would not take advice, and you called on them to fear Allah, but they would not fear him. O Commander of the Faithful, I testify that you waged jihad for the sake of Allah, a jihad that is worthy of him, until Allah summoned you to his vicinage and took you away by his will, and he took a testimony against your enemies for assassinating you, so that it may be a proof in your favor and against them, along with the conclusive proof that you have against all his creation. Peace on you, O Commander of the Faithful. You worshipped Allah with total dedication and struggled patiently for his sake. You sacrificed yourself while putting your trust in him. You acted in accordance with his scripture, followed the sunnah of his prophet, maintained the prayer, paid zakat, bade what is right and forbade what is wrong, to the utmost extent of your capacity, seeking that which is with Allah, desiring that which he has promised, being indifferent to adversities, without showing weakness in hardships, and being unflinching in the face of battles. Those who attribute to you any quality other than that lie and fabricate falsehoods against you, and woe to those who have swerved from you. Certainly you waged jihad for the sake of Allah, a worthy jihad, suffered patiently all the torments with a patience sprung from trust in Allah, and you were the first of those who believed in Allah, prayed to him, struggled and were the first ones to openly proclaim their faith in him in the house of idolatry and in a land filled with error where Satan was worshipped openly. You are the one who said, "The large number of people surrounding me does not increase my might and honor, nor their forsaking me makes me feel lonely and desolate, and that if all mankind were to forsake and betray me, I will not feel humiliated." You held fast to Allah, and you enjoyed honor and might, and you chose the hereafter over this world and led an ascetic life. Allah strengthened you and guided you. He made you dedicated in your faith and chose you. Hence, there was neither any contradiction in your actions, nor any inconsistency in your statements, nor any dissonance in your states. You did not make any false claims and fabrications against Allah, nor you had any greed for worldly vanities, nor were you defiled by sins. You have never ceased to be on a manifest proof from your Lord and a conviction in all your affairs, and you guided others to the truth and to the straight path. I affirm with a testimony that is honest and swear by Allah with an oath that is genuine, that Muhammad and his household, may Allah bless them, are the leaders of the creation, and that you are my master and the guardian of the faithful, and that you are a servant of Allah and his wali and brother of the Prophet and his heir and legatee. I affirm what the Prophet said to you, "By him who has sent me with the truth, those who deny you do not believe in me, and those who repudiate you do not acknowledge faith in Allah. Those who turn their back on you go astray, and those who are not guided by you will not be guided to Allah or to me." And that is the meaning of the words of my Lord, Almighty and Glorious. Indeed, I am an all-forgiving Lord toward those who repent, become faithful, and act righteously, and then walk on the right path of your wilayah. That ends the first part of the famous ziyara or salutation to Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the auspicious occasion of Ghadir Khan. Please tune in again tomorrow to hear the second part. Goodbye.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Yemen has experienced a back-to-back truce, badly needed one, given the humanitarian catastrophe in that country. So bad that the Red Cross has said that two-thirds of Yemenis are deprived of basic health care in unimaginable horror. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at this unimaginable horror, the U.S. complicity in this war. And even though the truce has been broken by the Saudis on more than one occasion, the reports that the U.S. may continue arms sales to the kingdom. Our guests joining us for this edition of the Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Yusuf Mowry, who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, the founder and editor of the independent news website, Multipolarista, Ben Norton, who joins us from Managua.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ben Norton, let me first start with you. We are looking at the fact that you have a humanitarian situation unfolding in the degree that it is. That's no surprise. But given at this point, we're talking about how the Red Cross says unimaginable horror and that two-thirds of Yemeni people are deprived of basic health care, why hasn't there been any headway made in that arena, given the fact that we're looking at somewhat of a truce that's now been held back-to-back? We're looking at 4 months of it now, roughly.
Well, the answer is because it's in the strategic interests of the West to continue this war after more than 6 years now. We see that the Joe Biden administration is trying to improve its relations with Saudi Arabia and essentially telling Riyadh that it's going to be able to continue waging this war. Now, Joe Biden has repeatedly claimed he wants to end the war, but the reality is that it's in the West's continued interest to support Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and continue providing weapons and military support. And of course, if this were another country waging war on Yemen, like Russia, I think there would be an international outrage that was led by the West. But because it's the West that's backing this war on Yemen, and because the U.S. dominates media narratives and uses its political power to pressure other countries into silence, there's very little discussion of the fact that the people in Yemen are suffering from the worst humanitarian catastrophe on Earth. According to the United Nations, more than 370,000 Yemenis have died in this war, and that's a conservative estimate. And again, we have to ask why. Well, the answer is very clear. It's because the West is backing this war, and according to the West, anything that they want to do is supposedly justified.
Well, you're there, Yusuf Mary, in Sana'a, and when you take a look at the way that Yemenis speak about the West, as a guest there talks about, what West are they referring to that's basically unleashed through the Saudi-led coalition the horrors that is unfolding? Do they blame Saudi Arabia only? Do they blame the U.S.? Who are they blaming?
All of the above. That's who the Yemeni people are blaming. In fact, the international community, any country that is not speaking out against the Saudi coalition and U.S.'s continuous propensity to want to expand over, even if it means spilling the blood of tens of thousands of innocent people, any country that's not speaking out or is remaining silent to the genocide that's taken place in Yemen, that's what the Yemeni people are blaming, but primarily Saudi Arabia, and of course its U.S. allies, right? You have Saudi Arabia, who's been receiving billions and billions of dollars worth of military aid from the U.S., and the Yemeni people have experienced the reality of what those weapons, what the repercussion of Saudi Arabia having those weapons is going to be. And that's going to lead into the death of tens of thousands of more innocent Yemenis. So again, to answer your question, anybody who is not speaking out against Saudi Arabia, against the U.S. for its continuous atrocities on Yemen, they should be held accountable and they should be blamed, right? Also, the U.N., the UN Security Council, any UN entity that's, you know, we have, you know, I was here last week and, we, you know, we did an interview about the humanitarian crisis in the country. And, you know, we're throwing numbers of tens of thousands of innocent people dying, you know, thousands and thousands of innocent children starving to death because of the blockade. And you have, you know, Amnesty International, you have the International Red Cross, the UN all speaking out and, you know, basically proclaiming that they want to help alleviate the humanitarian crisis. But that's not the fact. That's not the reality, because all they really want to do is, you know, use the case, the humanitarian case in Yemen, to justify, you know, making money, to justify getting donations from their sponsors, their donors. If they really wanted to end the suffering in Yemen, they would call on Saudi Arabia, call on the UN to lift the strangling blockade. The people are starving on the ground because of the blockade. Basic necessities is not able to enter the country. That's not because the Yemeni people are poor. That's not because Yemen doesn't have enough natural resources to feed its people. It's simply because there's an insidious blockade being imposed by the U.S., by the U.N., and the international community, who are turning a blind eye to the atrocities that are taking place. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine, on the other hand, you know, Amnesty International, the UN, every country has condemned Russia. And, you know, they're claiming, you know, this is a Russian invasion and Russia is killing innocent people and Russia is doing such, is doing this and is doing that. Not one of these entities is holding Saudi Arabia accountable. Not one of these nations or these entities is pointing the finger at the crown prince or the king of Saudi Arabia to tell him enough is enough.
Indeed. Well, when you look at it through that lens that our guests are from Sana'a just talked about there, Ben Orton, it shows UN complicity. And the only thing that comes to my mind is how Saudi Arabia, along with the U.S., are major contributors when it comes to the funding of the UN. We've known about how Saudi Arabia has actually been excused by the UN when it came to killing children in the war in Yemen and countless of other situations where, you know, they made excuses for Saudi Arabia. And, of course, this sheds another light and another angle to this. Do you think that that is the reason, if you agree with our guest there from Sana'a, that perhaps even the UN is complicit because this siege is not being lifted and people in Yemen are still suffering?
Well, we do know that the pressure of funding has been a significant factor in the United Nations inaction. In fact, the previous Secretary General Ban Ki-moon admitted that Saudi Arabia threatened to withdraw funding after the UN was going to put Saudi Arabia on its list of countries that violate the rights of children. So it's an objective fact that Saudi Arabia and the Western powers have used funding as blackmail to try to prevent the United Nations from taking action against this borderline genocidal war in Yemen. But we also know that inside the United Nations Security Council, which is the institution that has the most power, the U.S. has very frequently used its veto power to prevent any UN action. So I think it's very justified to criticize the UN. But at the end of the day, the weaknesses of the UN, I think, are reflections of Western imperialism and U.S. hegemony. The fact that the U.S. can use the UN to advance its geopolitical interests. And then when the UN tries to take actions that may in some way challenge U.S. interests, well, Washington can use its veto in the Security Council to block those resolutions. We've seen the United States many dozens of times has vetoed UN resolutions condemning apartheid Israel's illegal activities and occupation of Palestinian territories. So similarly, if the UN Security Council were to try to take action against Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, it's very likely that the United States and also potentially Britain and France would use their veto power to prevent any UN action against Saudi Arabia. So once again, Riyadh can only carry out this war and kill hundreds of thousands of Yemenis because it has support from Western imperialist powers. And honestly, if the United States were to say tomorrow, we are ending our support for this war, I think the war would end within a few days. But the response from the White House is, of course, the opposite. Instead, Joe Biden is saying, well, we want to improve our relations with Saudi Arabia in order to continue our war on Russia as well. So in Washington, the solution to all of these problems is never less war. It's always more war.
Well, let me open up then this question, which I'm almost sure that maybe you have either read it, Yousef Mari, or you've heard about it at this point, and that is the op-ed that Biden, the U.S. president, has written prior to his visit to the region, titled Why He's Going to Saudi Arabia. I mean, there in itself shows the level of, I don't want to say disillusion, because obviously either Biden wrote it himself or somebody wrote it for him. But it really is a far stretch from the reality. And I begin with this, Yousef Mari, where Biden says, the war in Yemen was escalating, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises with no political process. In Yemen, I named an envoy and engaged with leaders across the region, including the King of Saudi Arabia, to lay the foundation for a truce. What do you think when the U.S. president is saying that?
Well, he's obviously pushing the U.S.'s political agenda, and he's going to say whatever he's going to say to push that agenda. I mean, you have a president who's ignoring the death and the genocide of tens of thousands of innocent people in order to pursue and to continue the Western hegemonic international structure, right? And that's been the case. Biden, he's scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia in the next couple of days, and the reason why he's doing that is, you know, the U.S. has a propensity to beef up its allies with military weapons in order to continue Western expansion, in order to continue the U.S.'s interest dominance over the region. But what's interesting about this visit, this visit actually, is that the U.S. and Israel, they're actually laying the groundwork for a new security alliance to be established between the U.S., between Israel, and most of the Arab states, most of the Saudi-backed coalition. And the purpose of this visit is they want to create or connect military technology to combat Yemen. They're actually building a network of radars, detectors, weapon interceptors, and they want to use this military technology, unprecedented military technology, to attack Yemen, on demand. And not only attack Yemen, but they also want to counter any missile attacks by the Sana'a government towards Saudi Arabia or toward any of the countries that are waging this aggression on Yemen. And what's even more interesting is that the U.S. and the Israeli entity, they're actually using Yemeni islands. They're using Yemeni territory to build these military bases, to build these detectors, to build these sophisticated state-of-the-art radars. They're using the island of Saqatra, they're using the island of Mayun, and this is all Yemeni land that's being used to point its weapons and to point its missiles towards the Yemeni people. So this is an unprecedented event where you have a, you know, just think of NATO joining forces with the Arab coalition being led by the Israeli entity and the and U.S. supreme military technology all joining forces to wage war on Yemen. This is, you know, this is not propaganda. This is actually happening as we speak. So as we speak, in spite of the humanitarian crisis that's taking place on the ground, you have more military activity in preparation to wage an all-out war on Yemen. And from the looks of it, it's going to happen in the near future.
Mm-hmm. We're going to discuss that a little bit more. I need to open this op-ed more, because it's really incredible, Ben Norton, when you think about it. Another very controversial statement coming out of it, in a sense, is how the U.S. president says, after a year of our persistent diplomacy, this truce is now in place. News just came out today, exclusively, of course. Internal U.S. discussions on Saudi arms at early stage, decision likely to depend on Saudi efforts to end the war. So you have the U.S. announcing potential arms sales. Biden did sell arms back in November of 2021 to the tune of between $650 to $750 million. So how do you evaluate the way that Biden is presenting himself in this op-ed with this last viewpoint that I just presented?
Well, it's more of the same. Joe Biden claimed repeatedly during his presidential campaign that he would end the war in Yemen. And when he came in January of 2021, then in February, a few weeks after entering office, he claimed that he had reached a new agreement with Saudi Arabia and he was ending support for all offensive operations. Now, he claimed that the U.S. was continuing support for Saudi defensive operations, but of course, the very nature of the Saudi war is an aggressive war. It is a war that was launched in March 2015, bombing Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, with the support of the U.S., Britain, and France, has carried out tens of thousands of airstrikes. How can an airstrike be defensive? It's not defensive. So we see that from the very beginning, the Biden administration has been the master of trying to use this language that sounds like he's ending the war, that sounds like he's pursuing peace and diplomacy, but all he's really doing is redefining what the U.S. is doing in supporting Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, and then saying that he made progress. And similarly now, he says that he's going to pressure Saudi Arabia to end the war in Yemen and then going to start selling offensive weapons. Are we really supposed to believe that if Saudi Arabia says, oh, we're ending the war in Yemen, but we buy all of these weapons from the U.S., are we really supposed to believe that Saudi Arabia is not going to use those weapons? Then why is it buying those weapons? It's clearly buying those weapons with the intent to use them. And maybe Saudi Arabia says, okay, we have officially ended operations, and then it unofficially continues waging this war. And we also have to be clear, when Biden says that Saudi Arabia is going to engage in diplomacy, does that mean that it's going to recognize the de facto government in Yemen that governs the majority of where the population of Yemen lives, which is the Sana'a government? Is Saudi Arabia ever going to recognize that government? And of course, the answer is very unlikely. Saudi Arabia is still going to recognize the puppet regime, which was unelected in the south, as the illegitimate government of Yemen. So that's not a diplomatic solution. That's just kicking the problem under the rug and pretending like it no longer exists.
Okay, let's break this down with the information you gave us, Yousef Mowry. We're looking at the Socotra Island, where it is reported that the UAE is setting up a military base with Israeli cooperation and perhaps to have Israeli special operatives operating there along with the UAE. What type of purpose does that serve, and what are they doing to execute whatever military purposes they believe it serves them? If you can please explain that to us.
Well, they basically, so here's how it works in Yemen, right? With what's been, you know, has been empirically proven. The U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, they've come to the realization that they will not win the war inside of Yemen. In other words, they understand that they will not be able to topple, they will not be able to dethrone the Sana'a government from power because, one, the Sana'a government has a large portion of support from the Yemeni people, and they've managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the Yemeni people. They've tried over the past 7 years to overthrow, to dethrone the Sana'a government, and they failed miserably across the board to achieve this goal. So now, plan B, if you will, they will no longer try to take over the capital Sana'a. What they're going to do instead, actually, they're going to try to turn Yemen into another Gaza, whereby Yemen as a nation will be imprisoned. It will be besieged and surrounded with military bases to wage attack on demand anytime that they feel the need to do so. So just because they can't overthrow the government and just because they can't win the hearts and the minds of the Yemeni people, they're resorting to Plan B, which calls for the engulfing the entire nation with military bases and waging attacks anytime the Yemeni government, the Sana'a government, attempts to resuscitate the economy, anytime the Yemeni government attempts to rebuild its military and public institutions. They're basically hell-bent on keeping Yemen in the worst humanitarian crisis until they get the regime change that they want. So unless the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia get the regime change that they so desperately want, they're going to keep the Yemeni people starving to death. They're going to keep this strangling blockade imposed on the country. They're going to continue their airstrikes. They're going to continue their military offensive from all four corners of Yemen. And this is what the Socotra Island is being used for. This is what the island of Ma'un is being used for. This is what the northwest south is being used for in Yemen. Any place in Yemen, any area that's under the occupation of Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries is going to be used to continue waging this Saudi war on Yemen. And to answer your question, so this is what the plan is right now. Since they can't take over Yemen, since they can't get the regime change that they want, they're basically hell-bent on turning Yemen into another Gaza. Well, they basically want it to be a country without a thriving economy. They basically want the want Yemen to be without a military, and they want the country to be divided and in a state of chaos and instability.
When you want to break down the amount of incentive each entity has in this game, Ben Norton, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word game, in this process, we're looking at the United States, Saudi Arabia, obviously, and we're also looking, obviously, in the increasing role that Israel plays. It appears that the U.S. may be outnumbered when it comes to an incentive to have the scenario that our guest from Sana'a says to be executed, because even if Saudi Arabia, even if the U.S. does not want to pursue this war, Israel is pushing for that scenario that our guest from Sana'a is saying, and I'm sure that you have Saudi Arabia that perhaps maybe even laying out that as a condition in order for the situation or the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to improve, and arms sales being one of those prerequisites of Saudi Arabia. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think so, but the reality is that for the United States, they are, speaking frankly, unfortunately, the United States government does not care about the people of Yemen. It never has. It was waging a drone war that killed many Yemeni civilians. The Trump administration carried out raids that killed Yemeni children. The U.S. government sees Yemen as a chip in a game. I mean, you use the term game. Unfortunately, that's the way these policymakers in Washington see the world. They see countries not as countries representing sovereign people of flesh and blood. They see the countries as potential allies or enemies. And George W. Bush famously said that the perspective of the U.S. government is you're either with us or you're against us. And the U.S. government is trying to force every country around the world to join its alliance in a new Cold War that it's waging on both China and Russia. And of course, Iran is a strategic partner of both China and Russia. And that further incentivizes the U.S. and apartheid Israel to work together to pressure all countries in West Asia to take aggressive actions against Iran, to try to isolate Iran and also, of course, isolate China and Russia. So unfortunately, in terms of what U.S. interests are, the U.S. has no interest whatsoever in protecting the Yemeni people. The Joe Biden administration may claim for public relations purposes and you know, its public speeches that it cares about human rights. But I'm sure that when Biden sits down with Mohammed bin Salman, he's going to say very clearly, look, we're against Iran, we're against China, we're against Russia. You just have to do something publicly to get all of these people criticizing me off of my back. He's going to tell MBS that you should say that you formally ended the war, and we're going to continue as you informally continue this war. And I think the guest from Sana'a is correct that the U.S. strategy is to turn Yemen into a new Gaza and to try to get everyone around the world to just forget about it. Okay. And allow Saudi Arabia to continue occupying it, blockading it, and continuing a war, but a quiet war, so the White House doesn't have to deal with public criticism.
Thank you. Yusuf Mari from Sana'a, journalist and political analyst, thank you. Founder and editor of the independent news website Multipolarista, Ben Norton from Managua. With that, we come to an end for this.